Hello, and thank you for joining this MedCast series entitled Optimal Management of Lupus Nephritis. I'm Dr. Nihat Solomon. I'm a rheumatologist and associate professor of medicine at Midwestern University Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine and an adjunct faculty for the University of Arizona Rheumatology Division. I'm part of Arizona Arthritis Rheumatology Associates and practice at Phoenix and Glendale locations.
And I'm Dr. Andrew Sharabim. I'm a rheumatologist at Arizona Arthritis and Rheumatology Associates and also practice at Phoenix and the Glendale locations. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Midwestern University Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine and an adjunct faculty for the University of Arizona Rheumatology Division.
In this program, we'll focus our discussion on current and emerging treatment options for lupus nephritis and how the current treatment paradigm is changing to incorporate newer mechanisms of action in how the disease is controlled. To help us in our conversation, we're pleased to have Dr. Daniel Wallace. Dr. Wallace is the director of the Lupus Clinic at the Cal Autoimmunity Center and associate director of the Rheumatology Fellowship Program at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. He practices in Los Angeles, California. Thank you so much for joining us. Let us begin. So Dan, what's the incidence of lupus nephritis in patients suffering with systemic lupus erythematosus, and what percentage of those lupus nephritis patients will develop chronic kidney disease and even end-stage renal disease?
The prevalence of lupus in the United States overall, meeting 2019 criteria, has been estimated to be about 200,000. Even though many of these patients may have a touch of proteinuria, if you look at definitions of lupus nephritis, it's 40%. So we're talking about 80,000 people with lupus nephritis. And lupus nephritis is classified currently according to biopsy patterns, although this is changing and we can talk about that. As far as prognosis, we used to talk about optimizing therapy and that the traditional therapies for lupus nephritis were prednisone plus mycophenolate. And if you say that that is the gold standard for treating lupus nephritis up till very recently, then we had what I would call the one-third, one-third, one-third paradigm, where one-third of all patients had everything go away and went into complete remission on prednisone and mycophenolate. One-third improved, but then ultimately relapsed or had chronic progression. And one-third had no response.
So quite a variation in lupus nephritis and their response rates. So what challenges do you think that poses in treatment for these patients, given the heterogeneity, Andy?
You have patients from these walks of life and the indigent population, the catchment, and the populations that usually present with lupus and lupus nephritis as such, where you'll have everything from as vague as constitutional symptoms to robust and flagrant, proteinuria and hematuria. And then you have to deal with population studies where African-American males get hit the hardest, as well as Hispanic populations. So all of this and the heterogeneity of the lupus and lupus nephritis populations create almost a conundrum, if you will, when it comes to treatment and optimization of such.
Yeah, and with that, that's a perfect segue in terms of treatment paradigms. And currently, I know that up until recently, we would think about options such as prednisone and in the past, Cytoxan, and then more recently, Cellcept or mycophenolate. But now with some of these newer agents available, Dan, tell us a little bit about sort of what the treatment paradigm looks like now.
Well, let's go back in history. In the 1960s, the NIH did the first studies of management of lupus, and dialysis has only been available since 1960. And prior to that, most patients were dead within 2 years. So once we had prednisone to be able to use and to monitor, the NIH studies showed that there was maybe about a 70% five-year survival. But the problem was that at the NIH, they discovered that there was a significant rate of fibrosis or scarring. And even though the patients responded, ultimately the majority went into end-stage renal disease. So the NIH studies originally included cyclophosphamide given intravenously, cyclophosphamide plus azathioprine, or just using azathioprine. And interestingly, for the first 5 years, there was no difference between the groups, but ultimately they showed that cyclophosphamide had an advantage. However, you know, you're talking about women who are in childbearing years and all the complications of cyclophosphamide. So it wasn't until the mid-1980s that mycophenolate or mycophenolic acid started to be studied and used. A third of all patients with lupus in the United States are African American. And there's also a predominance in people of color. In the Sioux Nation, for example, one person in 70 has lupus. So it's extremely high in certain populations, and also Latina, Hispanics, and certain Asian populations, particularly Chinese, Filipino, have very high prevalences of lupus, and often their prevalence of nephritis is higher, and they don't do as well. The major cause of renal failure in this group is compliance or adherence. And because much of lupus nephritis, especially early, is if they're not nephrotic, they're asymptomatic, they feel okay. So they don't always are adherent with their appointments and with taking the medicines or being able to afford medicines, being able to afford transportation to clinics for their appointment, the ability to read and write English, ability to have somebody that they could call at 2 in the morning who knows about their case. So these are a lot of the reasons, but there was a study from Texas a few years ago that showed that the major reason for renal failure in lupus nephritis patients is lack of compliance or adherence with any of the factors that I mentioned. So once you get over that, and the major treatment for that is increased awareness, the Lupus Foundation of America, the Lupus Research Alliance, and lupus advocacy and support groups have been doing a lot of work with trying to make the lupus community in underserved areas aware of the needs to be more compliant and adherent. Then following that, then you could talk about some of the newer treatments. But before you talk about newer treatments, you have to talk about what flavor or what kind of lupus are you talking about. Historically, lupus has been a disease of the glomerulus, and there's 5 classifications. There's class 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, where the serious ones are 3 or 4, which is focal proliferative or diffuse proliferative, or membranous, which is class 5, and they often overlap, and maybe about 15% are mesangial or type 2 lupus. But there's some recent information that has been published showing that the interstitium is just as important, if not more important, than the glomerulus, because glomerular classification only roughly correlates with prognosis, whereas the interstitial, if you add that to it, makes a difference. Interstitial nephritis includes blood flow to the kidney, the fact that T follicular helper cells are pro-inflammatory, and there's also newer, better imaging that is going to take over our understanding. Historically, we've done a lot of biopsies on lupus patients, but it's not easy to get a biopsy. More people are getting it under ultrasound from interventional radiologists rather than with nephrologists. But there is a whole new area that's becoming important called functional MRI, where we can look at biomarkers such as interleukin-6, monocyte chemoattractant protein, and about 30 or 40 different other biomarkers which can be detected on a functional MRI and with the biopsy be give us a guide to prognosis. A lot of interstitial lung disease patients have Sjogren's overlaps because that's part of it along with renal tubular acidosis. But once we have the patient classified, then the first thing we have to do with treatment is look at reversibility, and that is on biopsies. We have something called a activity index and a chronicity index. These were devised by the NIH in the 1970s, and you want to have reversible kidney disease before you start to treat it. You don't want to treat a scarred fibrotic kidney. Other important factors that are not medication would include monitoring hypertension, for those who are nephrotic, looking at proteinuria, electrolyte balance, serum albumin levels, and also the use of ACE and ARB inhibitors to improve blood flow to the kidney, compliance with appointments, adherence with medication, and being able to isolate parse lupus nephritis from other forms of lupus. You could have cutaneous lupus and lupus nephritis, and being able to use the treatment for all those. If you want me to go on, I could, yeah.
Well, so. You talk about class 3 and class 4 being the more dangerous one, if you will, 3B maybe, along with 4. You talked about overlap with class 5, oftentimes membranous, and the utilization of steroids, but some of these new targets, are they focused specifically on those more dangerous forms of lupus nephritis?
Okay, so yes. So the point being that what do we use other than mycophenolate, cyclophosphamide, or prednisone? What are the four or five treatments that have come out for lupus nephritis in the last few years? The most important is probably belimumab. Belimumab has was studied in a remarkable trial that was a double-blind placebo-controlled trial that actually took 2 years, which required patients to be not know what they're getting for 2 years. And they were able to enroll almost 1,000 people in the study. And they were able to show that adding belimumab to mycophenolate made a statistically important difference. And also it's nice because belimumab, as you know, treats other aspects of lupus, such as arthritis, skin cutaneous disease, and sense of well-being, constitutional symptoms. So a lot of us are adding belimumab early. The only downside of adding belimumab is that it doesn't work right away. It takes 3 to 4 to 5 to even 6 months before it makes a difference. But clearly it makes a difference, and it is extremely safe. So that is now approved for lupus nephritis, belimumab, and belimumab is now approved in children with lupus, which is children with lupus have a 70% prevalence of nephritis and much more severe disease. As far as other general agents that have been used in lupus nephritis, the only other the other biologic that's approved is anifrolumab, and anifrolumab is currently being studied in phase 3 trials. I can tell you that anybody with more than 2 grams of protein was excluded from the pivotal trials that got FDA approval for nephritis, but we have a lot of data on people between 500 milligrams and 2 grams of protein in a 24-hour urine that suggests that anifrolumab also helps lupus nephritis in the same way, in the same percentage that belimumab. There's been no head-to-head comparisons. The other drugs that have been used more recently for lupus nephritis that are on the market is that there's a drug called voclosporin, which is FDA approved for lupus nephritis. This falls in the family of CNIs or calcineurin inhibitors. There are actually 4 or 5 different CNIs that have been used for lupus nephritis. Historically, cyclosporin was used for membranous nephritis with some success, except for it can raise a creatinine and it can raise blood pressure, at least in the beginning, before stabilization. So a lot of people have been using tacrolimus. Actually, in certain parts of the world, such as in Asia, CNIs are used much more than mycophenolate, and that's for cost reasons, because those drugs are proprietary. Mycophenolate is proprietary in Asia, and it's very expensive. So tacrolimus, which is generic, is used a lot. The problem with tacrolimus is that it can give you paresthesias. You have to measure drug levels. The dose is constantly being changed. But it is safe with pregnancy and safe with breastfeeding and childbearing. So a lot of people prefer to use that. It sort of replaced azathioprine as the drug for people who want to maintain their reproductive integrity. There's also rapamycin, which is used more for people who've had transplants. And all these drugs are used in people who've had transplants, albeit in much lower doses. And then, especially in Asia, such as in Hong Kong or Singapore, there's a lot of centers that are combining different treatments, combining mycophenolate with tacrolimus, combining these. And voclosporin is recently available. I think there's papers at this meeting that are coming out showing that it has very robust results, and it's extremely safe. It's a lot. It doesn't raise the blood pressure. It doesn't alter the creatinine. It's very well tolerated for lupus nephritis. But again, if you have extra renal disease, you might also want to be on belimumab. But we're actually, it's hard to get it insured, covered. But a combination of voclosporin with belimumab appears, at least in personal experiences of us, to have a good result. So those are the ones that are available or approved. And then, and above and beyond that, you have biologics that are on the market but not approved for lupus. The most commonly used one would be rituximab. And rituximab has by itself has been a little bit disappointing, but in combination with mycophenolate, it is very good, and it also treats extrarenal lupus. The problem with rituximab is it's chimeric, and it's a monoclonal antibody to CD20. But there is another drug that's on the market but not approved for lupus called obinutuzumab, which is fully human. It's made by the same sponsor. And that, again, at this meeting, is going to be, I think, a late breaking on the use of obinutuzumab with their phase 3 trial. And this has extremely robust results with deltas between the control group of like 20 to 30% improvement. And we're going to be hearing a lot more. Obinutuzumab is approved for lymphoproliferative disorders and leukemia, so it is available, but it's not reimbursable, and it's very expensive. There are some other drugs that have been studied for lupus nephritis that are biologics. There have been about 5 studies with abatacept, which targets the T cells, and they appear to have modest to slight effects, so probably would not be in our armamentarium. The IL-17, IL-23s that are used for, let's say, psoriasis, such as secukinumab, have been studied in lupus nephritis. The first study that came out was disappointing, but there are others from other sponsors that are in progress. We have not really had looking at small oral molecules whether it's JAK inhibitors or TYK2. We don't have a lot of information with those, but a lot of patients are being put on lupus. There is a very, the sponsors of AbbVie just finished a upadacitinib lupus trial, which was very interesting because the 15 milligram dose that's used for rheumatoid arthritis was a failure in lupus, but the 30 milligram dose, which is used in inflammatory bowel disease, was successful. So now they're doing a phase 3 30 milligram dosing.
Well, you've certainly walked us through a multitude of different ideas and treatment options, as well as things on the horizon. I'd like to hear from you, Andy, as far as Dr. Wallace had mentioned combination therapy. Where do you see combination therapy? How do you use combination therapy in your practice?
I believe it's extremely important, as that, as Dr. Wallace alluded to, this is a, it has to be a multifaceted approach. We have to have more of an armamentarium because lupus is, you know, not one size fits all for these patients. It's very heterogeneous. So with that in mind, you want as much at your disposal as possible. And this is not even excluding what also Dr. Wallace alluded to, lifestyle and modifications as such. So these patients are coming in with comorbid conditions, blood pressure issues, flow. Like we discussed, renal flow is a big part of this, the interstitium, and therefore any medication that we can get our hands on that treats lupus from every angle, along with lifestyle modifications and understanding comorbid conditions and their role to play, is paramount. So I believe that it is, there is more work to be done, but it's great with the advent of all of these mechanisms of action at least showing promise. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it sounds like the idea is broad spectrum, if you will, treatment of lupus. If you can catch the lupus nephritis with a drug like belimumab, even before it even begins, if you will, it seems to be the mode of the future. There are calcineurin inhibitors, as you alluded to, and the more recent one, voclosporin, showing lots of promise, but also lots of safety, if I heard you correctly. And the idea of utilization this in combination with other available therapies may prove to have not just the kidneys, but also with the combination of other treatments, the entire disease in and of itself. But it really does sound like it comes back to education, compliance, making sure that this population is doing what it needs
it's
to do.
It's a multidisciplinary effort. Regionally, there's some areas where there's not enough rheumatology. There's other areas where there's not enough nephrology, where it's months to get in to see. There's health plans where you have to go to a primary care before you have access to rheumatology. So there's so many psychodynamic issues that interfere with the optimal care of lupus, and also lupus awareness from the lupus advocacy groups, whether it's the Arthritis Foundation, the Lupus Research Alliance, the Lupus Foundation of America. There's two or three other regional lupus organizations. There's no one lupus group, which also hampers the ability to communicate.
So if we want to dig deeper, all things being equal, and I know they're not, but all things being equal, if we wanted to choose for lupus nephritis based on treatment guidelines, I know our kidney colleagues, our nephrologists out there have their KDIGO guidelines, and we have EULAR guidelines. Hopefully soon ACR will also have lupus nephritis specific
guidelines.
Yeah,
I'm on the committee for ACR. We've had one meeting about 3 months ago, and I think it'll be another year or two before there are guidelines. There were EULAR guidelines in 2019. Essentially, the recommendations are prednisone in the beginning, taper as quickly as possible, use mycophenolate, and if you are refractory to this regimen, add calcineurin inhibitors, add rituximab, substitute azathioprine, although azathioprine is no longer used for induction, it's only used for maintenance. Mm.
And with these newer agents, where do you see the horizon being with maybe future guidelines?
you know, nobody's really looked at the cytokine blockers such as tocilizumab. There are a variety of drugs that are used for, let's say, myeloma that are B cell targets. There are certain T cell targeted therapies that do more than just targeting interferon, such as anifrolumab, but they also block plasmacytic dendritic cells, toll-like receptors, and other mechanisms. This is really a very exciting time because I lived through the desert of having 30 years with nothing. When I was a fellow in the 1970s, we had azathioprine, we had cyclophosphamide, we had methotrexate, we had prednisone, and then for like a 30-year period, there was nothing.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting perspective. And where do you see kidney biopsy versus maybe measurements like urine protein creatinine ratios fit into monitoring and optimizing treatment?
I think kidney biopsies, there was a period where nobody wanted to do it. But kidney biopsies should be done, and the only at onset. Because there's things you could find out. You could find out there's thrombotic changes. You could find out there's a lot of interstitial changes. If you're diabetic, you could have diabetic nephropathy. Sometimes, even rarely, a lymphoproliferative process coexisting with lupus could be identified. So it's important, and sometimes you could even get a post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis. So you want to make sure there's no infection, there's no lymphoproliferative process, there's no diabetes or confounding factor. So everybody should get a biopsy. Doing a second or third biopsy can be done if there's a significant change. 30% of all classifications change at a second or third biopsy, but now with functional MR, which is, there are certain companies that are working on this, where you can look at biomarkers, will make a huge difference. But it's not really ready for prime time. It's an evolving dynamic.
Sounds like biomarkers are on the horizon for a multitude of different diseases that we treat. So I'll ask you, that was the segue to my next question. Do you know of any biomarkers in the near or far future, and what does that look like for us?
Well, Andras Perl in Syracuse had a project with the NIH where he was able to come up with 250 different biomarkers for different lupus nephritis. And there are some people that swear by one biomarker, some people that swear by another. Michelle Petrie at Johns Hopkins has put together a composite index where she takes four or five biomarkers and weighs them. And she uses it, and she attests that it's very helpful, except for it's not been independently confirmed. There's two or three other centers that say they couldn't do it. So it's in process.
So for the average Joe, you know, one of us, working in clinical practice, what do you think an effective measure, if you will, of disease outcome in general for lupus would be, and then sort of zero it in if they have predominantly lupus nephritis?
Well, first of all, in clinical trials, damage index are very helpful, the indices are very helpful. But in clinical trials, it's impossible to do damage index because it's a one-year trial, and at 1 year, nothing changes. So what you need to do is study the open-label extension patients and study them for 5 years, 10 years. And the ACR with SLIC is currently embarking on a revision of the damage index, which was put together in the 90s and is obsolete. So once we get new markers, a new damage index, then if the point being is that lupus progresses very incrementally, even though the SED rate's normal, the CRP is normal, the creatinine's normal. So it's a matter of picking up these very subtle changes in the damage index. And that's going to happen in the next year or two. It'll, and it won't be in the 1 year drug trials, but it will be in observational studies where we then correlate damage with disease progression. Also, you could have interstitial lung disease getting better at the same time autoimmune hemolytic anemia is getting worse. So you have different organ domains. BILAG is like 9 organ domains. And they're all weighted differently. So like there's, we call soft BILAG Bs and hard BILAG Bs. A hard BILAG B would be cardiac or pulmonary changes, whereas soft BILAG B, which gets the same number of points, is arthritis. So that needs to be sorted out.
Sure, sure, absolutely. And what about measures like SLEDAI and UPCR? Is that something that you do regularly in your clinic, or do you just reserve those for clinical trials?
I only, in California, Blue Cross requires after 6 months that you show them a SLEDAI score. So we have to do SLEDAI scores. Epic, which is our medical record, has a thing that we can embed SLEDAI in there. But SLEDAI takes 1 minute to fill out. It's really easy. Whereas BILAG is 9 organ domains with something like 92 different factors, and it's impossible, and it's not consistent from center to center if you don't do clinical trials. None of these domains, BILAG, neither BILAG nor SLEDAI, are good for nephritis. So then we have something called the complete renal response, or the CRR, which is like the fifth iteration of it, which is creatinine clearance and the amount of proteinuria. But even those are problematic, and we really need a better measure, and hopefully some of the biomarkers, once we get our act together, will demonstrate that.
Yep. So lastly, I want to dig a little bit more. You mentioned JAK inhibitors, and it seems like we don't really know jack about JAK inhibitors, right? And JAK selectivity, now we've been using JAKs for a while in rheumatoid arthritis and dabbling in psoriatic arthritis, among others. But now there are some trials looking at JAK selectivity in lupus. How do you see the preliminary results of that and potential for maybe targeting lupus nephritis, if at all?
Okay, so Zeljanzor has not really been studied in this group at all. Upadacitinib, I mentioned that the higher dose appears to work. Unfortunately, the baricitinib studies never used a high enough dose. But there is a, they have studied some other biomarkers in the area that are related to JAK, but not JAK. There's BTK inhibitors, Bruton tyrosine kinase, and this has been shown actually to have favorable results in Sjogren's, and it also has favorable results in leukemia and lymphoma and in myasthenia gravis, but it's, two companies did trials with it in lupus that were negative. But then we have deucravacitinib, which is a TYK2 drug that is now approved for psoriasis. And two sponsors are doing nephritis studies with this drug. And it appears to be very, very promising and perhaps safer than JAK in that they don't have any thromboembolic issues. And they're very, very well tolerated. So it's an evolving area.
Fascinating. So I'd like to finally recap our final thoughts. Andy, I'll start with you.
Sure. Again, an exciting time to be in medicine, especially in rheumatology. As Dr. Wallace had stated, he waited decades before he can utilize biologic, if just another tool in his armamentarium to battle lupus and lupus nephritis, which again is a very heterogeneous and complicated task. But of course, I feel that in the coming years, we will be up to it. And I love what Dr. Petrie is doing, Johns Hopkins and Exogen, teaming up to try to patent biomarkers that at least would help us navigate that a little bit easier if that comes to fruition.
She's working with PC4D to better identify the group that may be at risk for thromboembolic disease, and she's also looking at hydroxychloroquine blood levels. And hydroxychloroquine is an important part of being given that it's part of all this, and that the blood levels are much better than the 5 mg per kilo dosing, and that that's a good guide to dosing therapy as well.
Certainly quite the journey that we're having with our lupus patients, and very exciting times, especially when we've had such a dearth in treatments, and now seemingly
I started with nitrogen mustard in 1975.
Amazing.
That is rather remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you everybody for joining us today in this MedCast series.